Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies. In a world where action movies are constantly exploding at the box office, our heroes take on the monumental task of dissecting and analyzing all aspects of action movies to truly understand what it takes to make a great action film. Ben Bateman, Andrew Guy, in a Popcorn Talk Network exclusive, this is Action Movie Anatomy.
Explosion! What's up, everybody? Welcome to the show! Welcome to Action Movie Anatomy on Popcorn Talk, the online movie network dedicated to talking movies and all things movie-related. This is Action Movie Anatomy, and I am your host, Ben Bateman, joined today by the all... I call you wonderfully dressed every week. I gotta come up with something better.
How about...
The man in the black tie, Andrew Guy.
I feel like that's worse than
really?
The other... I'd rather be wonderfully dressed.
It's factually correct.
Can we start over? Can we do this again?
We roll it again.
You have to say something about the purple, though. It's gotta be...
It's vibrant.
Purple person.
I always do. I usually reference
so
the color
pink
of his
or purple.
Shirt.
Hi, guys. Happy to be here. Excited to talk about the movie.
Guys, if you watch this show, you know we love her. She is excellent.
Emily
I was
going to
say
Blunt.
The best, but I didn't want to offend Steph Z.
The long pause was just so painful, though. It was like, what's going to come out?
I thought we were going to talk about Emily Blunt.
We love Emily Blunt. We talk about her frequently. We have Roxy Stryer.
Thank you guys for having me back. I really appreciate it.
Oh, we're so excited.
And I agree. Steph Z is the best. So I'll take second place to her anyway.
She is great.
Fun piece of trivia, guys. We have done, including today's film, Minority Report, starring Mr. Tom Cruise from 2002. One of my favorites.
One of my favorite movies.
One of my favorites.
You have to listen to me. We have done six Tom Cruise movies on the show now, I believe. Or is it five? Mission Impossible? Five. We've done Mission Impossible 3, 4, 5, Edge of Tomorrow.
And this movie.
And this film. Hilariously enough, Steph Z and Roxy Stryer have accounted for all of the appearances.
Yes.
Ooh,
every Tom Cruise appearance.
She's beating me right now a little bit.
Three episodes.
Yeah.
So today, guys, we are doing Minority Report.
Which is funny. Oh, sorry.
Adapted Philip K. Dick novel of a different name. No, I guess the original story was called The Minority Report, but this is 02. This is right sort of in the transition of Cruise's career from trying to win an Oscar to I'm just going to do action movies and be really good at that. And it's awesome. We loved it. We're very excited to talk about it. So I think we're gonna cue up the trailer, and then we'll talk about the show's context and this, that, and the other.
It's funny. We always talk about how we're going to try to stay away from Cruise.
It's impossible.
Yeah.
You guys, you say you're going to try to stay away?
Well, because there was that stretch where we did two Cruise movies in a row with 4 and 5, and it was just like the audience is like, really?
And we had done three like a couple months prior, and like we just talked about them a lot. So I think it's like our audience, like one of the comments on iTunes was like more like Tom Cruise anatomy.
Whammy.
Like,
he's a huge part of the action scene.
The canon.
Yeah, he is. I get why you guys are always cruising.
Ben has a poster of Cruise on his ceiling. That was very good.
How about when he walks into his house and there's one that he kisses on his way in?
That's a true
guys,
story.
That's not true.
That's a true story.
That's an actual true story about Ben Bateman.
It's not.
But you don't like him that much. No.
Cruise?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's cool.
He's whatever. Right. He's whatever.
He's whatever. So, interesting thing about this trailer. Roxy was just on recently and did the Bourne Identity plug for the show. You guys should check it out. This is another trailer from within that, like, 2 or 3 years. They're all kind of exactly the same.
Yeah.
They start out, and it's like, scene, 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 and then it's like, text across the screen, right? Watch here. It's going to be like, we start. It's like, we can see the future, right? Yeah. The future can be seen. And then it's like, scene, 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 illustrate what we're talking about. Scene, 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 illustrate. And then it'll give us another one. You know what I thought about it? And the reason that I think it's so, like, strange and seems so out of place when they do it in these trailers...
Murder.
...is because everything else that you see in here is in the movie.
Yes.
But the writing is, like, just this kind of cheap construct that
right, well, now what they do is they take lines that people deliver throughout the piece...
Exactly.
...and they use that in the trailer instead of just, like, I want to write something. Why do we have a voice for the writing?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it is interesting. Like, it just popped up. The system can't be wrong. Like, there's a line that said that. Like,
yeah,
just put that.
Saying it.
I kind of like it though.
No,
it makes it a little more intense.
Do you know what would happen nowadays if this was made and they would? Because at this point, they figured out how to do Cruise trailers.
Mm-hmm.
They have lines in the movie delivered that are not actually in the movie for the trailer.
Oh yeah,
it's like from outtakes and
they
stuff.
They would literally have Cruise go into a sound booth, and this would start out, and it would be the thing, and then it'd be like. the future can be seen. That's how the trailer would start.
How do I get a pair of those gloves that he wears?
Yeah, they're sweet.
Yeah, it's pretty badass.
Is Cruise underrated? No.
Absolutely, he's not underrated.
This movie is, though.
This movie is. Now, okay. That'll be part of my fist pump.
What just happened? Did you get a tweet or something? Or
it's our live feed.
Oh, yeah. I thought it just popped into your head. Like, my quick brain. Question for you guys.
Is Cruise underrated? Yeah, so it's not a terrible trailer. Honestly, it's difficult to make a bad Steven Spielberg trailer just because...
It's Steven Spielberg.
Visually, he's kind of a master, so there's so much good that you can throw into the trailer here. Mm-hmm. It would be hard to jam a bunch of the cool scenes together and have it be bad. But definitely the text component is kind of bad, and it feels fairly
It's not
dated.
As bad as the Matrix trailer, though.
I mean, the Matrix, The Bourne Identity, Gladiator, this movie, they're all out of all them, Bourne Identity is the worst.
Do you guys remember when this trailer came out, though, feeling like you didn't like it?
No. That's the thing, is that at the time, all of the trailers were fine.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I still think the Gladiator trailer's fine.
So we're going to get into this in just a second. That was the trailer from Minority Report. Guys, we do action movies on this show. They adhere to four basic rules. Aside from coming out after 1981, the four rules are, number one, the hero and the villain are always the smartest people or things or beings or aliens or dinosaurs in the room. Rule number two, the hero always plays by his own rules is rule number one, but they can be reversed. It doesn't matter. Rule number three, the hero is always a police, military, or political figure. And then rule number four, there's at least one explosion. I think this movie hits
absolutely
all of them.
Yeah.
The only thing would be that the villain, who's
he's the smartest?
Well,
it's Max.
Yeah, I definitely think he's the smartest.
Yeah,
you and think he's like, oh, dude. He's orchestrated this entire thing.
Was the question, do you think he's the villain, or was the question, is he the smartest guy?
Well, the first question is there's two people that could be the villain, but in the end, he's the real villain. And then, is he the smartest guy in the room, or...
He faked a murder right after it had happened.
Yeah, he didn't fake it, he actually murdered.
Well, he faked the first one.
And, spoiler alert, he kills Colin Farrell, who's like sort of the other smartest guy.
But were you calling him the potential other villain?
No, I was just pondering for saying he was the smartest guy. That's all. But yeah, he is. You're right.
He is. So, yeah.
So, all right. So
it's Farrell. Farrell, if you were going to call Farrell the
villain, he's awesome.
I mean, like, he gets killed by Burgess, but
he's not the smartest guy.
But he is. Killed. But he also figures out everything right then.
Right after that point.
But he doesn't figure out that it's him.
Yeah, but he if he doesn't figure out it's him, then he's not the smartest guy because he got outsmarted.
But he's not looking for him as the bad guy. The hero is Tom Cruise, and he essentially gets him fired from his job.
Right.
And then he figures out the whole plot.
Well, that's why it fits in the guidelines, because he's not the hero or the villain, so we don't care how smart he is.
Exactly.
We're debating the rules, guys, and we frequently break them, so don't worry about it. If you watch the show, then you know we have a good time, and I think it pretty much hits the rules. So we are going to get into our fist pumps and our thesis statements. I'm done. I'm quitting the show. I'm done. But what I do want to say really quickly before we do this is this movie, incidentally, is coming out at this review is coming out at the same time as the show, Minority Report, which is...
Is it incidentally? I feel like it was very well planned by you guys.
So maybe there's a reason we did Minority Report this week.
Coincidentally.
Is there a show?
Yeah, there's a show. It's on Fox. It's the first episode starts out with basically like the plot of this movie, and then it opens up with one of the brothers from the Proton Goo being like this guy who's trying to solve murders. Honestly, I haven't watched it yet, but... It just premiered, and we are doing an AfterBuzz TV, our sister network here, to Popcorn Talk, an AfterBuzz TV after show that is going to be on, Mondays?
Mondays at 7.
7 o'clock.
Yeah.
And you guys should check that out if you want to check out the show, if you want to watch the what have you, and if you want to do this movie, because this is obviously a great like launch pad into the show, then you can do both. So please do that, as well as check out the other shows on Popcorn Talk. There's a show called Anatomy of a Movie, which is on Fridays. They cover brand new releases every single week. It's very similar to our format. It's just a little bit more in-depth with kind of not as many games that we play on this show. But that's awesome. And then lastly, guys...
Plug my popcorn talk show. DC Movie News.
And then Roxy
kept looking at me like you could plug it.
You're on here, he's like, there's Marvel Movie News, and that's it. That's the only other show on the whole network.
Like, I have a show. It's on this network.
Guys,
God damn it, Ben
Bateman. There's a great show. It's called Marvel Movie News. Are you guys going to see Deadpool? Roxy does one called DC Movie News. She's very passionate about it. Roxy, do you want to just talk about it yourself?
I love that show. And we tape Thursdays at 2:45 frequently. Sometimes we tape at different times, but we love you guys. You guys have been awesome, so come check it out if you like everything DC related.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ben, for letting me do that.
100%. 100%. The last thing, guys, is that we have been plugging for a little while. We're making these Action Movie Anatomy mugs. We've been randomly selecting folks to give them away to, though they haven't come in yet, as you can see.
Well, we also haven't gotten... we got to have you guys reach out to us. We got to get your address, and we got to know where to mail them.
Yes, because... And we will list out your names at the end, the ones that have already won, as well as selecting one more. But the rules, how that works, is you have to go go to the iTunes page and you have to give us a rating and a review. And once we get to 20 reviews, because we have 19 ratings and 16 reviews right now, we're going to start giving a few more away. So help us get to 20. Check out the iTunes. You guys have been awesome so far, saying some really nice things about us.
Yeah, we love reading those comments. They really...
Yeah, it's pretty sweet. Yeah. So that's awesome, and we'll auction off, randomly select one more mug to be given away at the end of the show, guys. Let's get into Minority Report. We're going to start this off with our thesis statement. So the thesis statement, the way this works is it's like a strong idea, something rooted in fact, kind of hyperbole. There should be no, like, this is my favorite, this, that, and the other, or like, he has a really sweet line. It should be like, this is the greatest, or this is one of the top five this, or this started this thing, and it should be a strong idea, which we all think very hard about construct, and Roxy tends to have pretty strong ones. So I'm gonna
She's
start.
Like really proud of her. Oh no, it was your recast. You're super.
No, excited. Yeah, my recast is amazing, but you're gonna have to wait for that. I think that this is something I hope that we can all agree on, or maybe not, and then we could get into some fights.
I love fighting.
Yeah. Okay. Andrew, let Roxy talk.
Okay, fine. I think that this is the most underrated Spielberg and Cruise movie of all time.
Son of a bitch.
Literally, Drew's exact thesis.
That is my exact thesis statement.
So I'm really glad you went second.
Yeah, well.
Wow, you guys, that was not planned?
That was not okay, so I stayed over last night. Yeah, that's stayed true. Up all night trying to make a thesis statement.
Yeah.
No, that is... Wow. Okay.
Okay. Well,
Roxy
that...
was like hiding and heard you say it to me because she didn't have her own and just like stole it. Just
like, oh,
me.
No, first.
Both of your faces while I was saying it was like, yeah. Spit it out so we can talk about why it's Andrew's also. I was like, oh, something wrong with it.
Mine's similar, but it's a little more specific. But that's incredible that yours.
Mine's similar, but better.
Okay, read. Well, what's it say? What is it? I want the exact wording on yours.
I don't ever write it down.
Oh, you don't write it down?
No.
Oh, well, mine's typed, so that's how you know that mine's true.
Yeah, my blueprint was in my head.
You could have just copied mine. Whatever I would have said, you would have said that was yours too.
Now we're just getting out of
it. You guys are
just absurd.
You guys are just bickering. Roxy, why don't you go do DC movie news or something, okay?
Is it Marvel or DC that you do?
Oh my god, you already stood up for me. Shoot. Okay.
Okay, yeah. Oh, well, that is literally my exact thesis statement, is that this is the most overrated or underrated, overlooked Steven Spielberg and Tom Cruise movie.
So ditto.
Yeah, ditto. Mm.
Oh, for both of them, not like a movie together.
No, for both of them.
Each of them individually.
They don't have that many movies together.
Yeah, two.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Just making sure.
Yeah, no, separately.
Interesting. Wow.
I feel like if you ask anyone out there, hey, what are your top five Spielberg movies?
Yeah.
What are your top five Cruise movies?
Never.
I feel like very rarely will Minority Report be either of those.
I literally wrote down the top... That's what I did. I wrote down the top five Cruise movies and Spielberg movies and how Minority Report isn't either of those. It's on my paper. It's on it.
So,
we're in the same great minds, you know?
So I'm going to jump in with mine, and it's very similar to yours, actually, but it's like just sort of at it from a little bit of a different angle, and it has the same approach, the top five approach. So what I'm going to say is that Minority Report is the first of the three Tom Cruise cult classic blockbusters.
Yeah.
There's three that he's made. And what I mean when I say that is that these are films that came out with high financial expectation, did reasonably well at the box office, but weren't considered successes by any means relative to some others. And then within about a year or two of release, were kind of swept under the rug culturally.
Like,
not really talked about, not discussed. But anytime you bring up one of these movies with someone who's seen it and likes it, it's one of their favorite movies.
Absolutely.
They love it. And if you were to try to make a top five list, most people's would never include this movie. So the three films that he made, Minority Report is the first one. Mm-hmm. And I'll talk about why I think that is and why this one in particular sort of hits that. The second one is Mission Impossible 3 in 06, which I think is another movie. And that one very specifically, we've talked about this on the episode that we did for that. That one went under the rug because it was right at the time that Cruise's public stock was just falling.
Also, when we talked to people about it that have watched the movie, the things that we loved about it the most is kind of what people didn't want in a Mission Impossible movie.
It was darker than people
wanted.
It was
too heavy. It was too dark. It wasn't... Yeah.
Yeah. And the last one, and this is maybe a reach because it's brand new, is Edge of Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And that's a movie that, again, did not perform particularly well at the box office. A lot of people didn't watch it. Mm-hmm. But those that did, it's one of their favorite movies. I've seen that movie probably 12 times. And I think that in 10 years, people will remember Edge of Tomorrow in almost the exact same way they remember Minority Report. They're very similar, in my opinion.
And to go along with your thesis statement here, it's very interesting because we obviously look at the views of our videos that we post for this show.
On YouTube, yeah.
And other than Mad Max, which is just like a runaway train, it's like 700,000 views.
Good job, guys.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, we're very... Thank you, guys. The other ones are Mission Impossible 3, Man on Fire, and Edge of Tomorrow. Those are three of the biggest ones.
And I would say that Man on Fire has the same exact kind of appeal we're talking about, which
That's
is
one of my favorites.
It's awesome. It's the same thing. You bring it up, and anybody that thinks about that movie loves that movie.
Right. Or even if they don't, they're like, I don't know. And then you make them watch it, or you watch it with them, like, oh my great. God, that movie's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating, actually, that Minority Report, when we were watching it, I was just sort of struck by, I mean, we'll talk about this when we get to box office, but after adjusted gross, this is Spielberg's 17th highest grossing movie.
Right. Mm.
After adjusted box office, this was the 17th highest grossing film of 2002, mm-hmm. and it's only Cruise's 11th. I mean,
and there's a lot of other movies that you would not believe are in front of this that year.
It's just such a testament to the two people that you just mentioned, though. I mean, Spielberg has a million things that he's done that are incredible, and so does Cruise. If mm-hmm. you had named two other names, maybe it would have been number one, number two.
Yeah,
right, but you think that if the two of them teaming up at the time, because this was right before Tom Cruise's fall.
So about four years. So
you would think that those two names doing a movie like this would be massive, but it just, I think it was too dark for the time. And we find this out a lot when we do movies that are older and they're like darker. This movie is, that was another thing that I was going to, for my other thesis statement that I thought about, was that this is the darkest movie that Tom Cruise has ever done.
Right.
Like as an action film and Spielberg.
Which is strange because it's very brightly lit. The whole thing is kind of white and overexposed, and then it's this really dark, gritty feel. It was interesting. I love that.
I think one of the reviews that I remember reading about just in the last day or two was it's like illuminated chrome, reflective and constantly moving is what they refer to the movie as.
Right.
Which is really interesting. It's like sort of bluish, and it's just, but it's, and it's almost like represented in the utopian vehicles that are going through the city. Everything is kind of similarly colored. It all moves very smoothly. Everything is constantly in motion. Very soulless. But, yeah, so, I mean, if you talk about each of those movies, like, you can, and I don't want to get too much into this because we've done this before on an episode with the sort of, like, phases of Cruise.
Uh-huh.
Sort of, if you break his career into, like, pieces, you can look at it as, like, three or four different sort of chunks. But
right.
This movie comes right when he made the transition from, I'm Tom Cruise, action star, trying to win an Oscar, which mm-hmm. was the 90s, most of the 90s. You know, Jerry Maguire and Magnolia, Eyes Wide Shut, Vanilla Sky was 01. Yeah. Right, he did Mission Impossible 2 a couple years before this, but ultimately this is like the transition back into I'm a big budget action star and that's what I'm good at, because he does this movie, he follows it up with The Last Samurai, right? He dips his foot for Collateral, which is kind of the same thing as trying to win an Oscar, but it's also Michael Mann and it's kind of action-y. He's an assassin. War of the Worlds is 05, and then the stock falls, and that's when Mission Impossible 3 happens. So I think that when this movie happened, there was just sort of a sense of, like, Tom Cruise has been off the radar as an action guy for a while, sci-fi, I'll wait. Maybe I won't see this one.
Right.
Right. 06, the wheels had come off. And why Edge of Tomorrow was unsuccessful financially, I don't know.
Well, but it's interesting, too, because War of the Worlds was so successful.
Hugely successful.
And this was, what was that, 3 years later?
Mm-hmm.
After this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was massive. And it's the same type of thing. Huge director, you know, aliens,
you know,
sci-fi, that whole thing.
And then I'm surprised that they didn't make more movies together after that.
It's right. Because of the Scientology.
It's because of, exactly.
Right.
It's because on the press tour for War of the Worlds, Spielberg spoke out and was like, he's getting a little out of hand here. I don't, you got to separate yourself from the, and that's when things started.
Right, but Spielberg works with a lot of crazy people, I feel like.
Yeah.
I guess that's a step too
but
far.
But it's when people cross his ideals when he has an issue. That's like why Megan Fox got fired from the Transformers series when she called Michael Bay a Nazi.
Okay,
Spielberg was like, you're done.
Right.
All right, let's move along.
Yeah, so anyway, that's our thesis statement. I think it's interesting. I like this movie. I like where it's positioned. So now we're going to get into Fist Pump Moment. Fist Pump Moment, guys, for those of you that watch the show, you know this. It's that moment when you're watching a movie. Maybe you're on the couch by yourself. Perhaps you've had a glass of wine. I don't know what you like to drink. Maybe you're sober, but you're watching this movie and something cool happens.
Yeah, right.
And it could be anything. It could be a movement in the score. It could be a conversation between the two main characters. It could be a one-liner. It could literally just be an exterior shot. Anything. And you just have this moment where you're like, God, this is awesome. And you're like looking around, you're like, are you guys seeing this right now?
Yeah.
Who's, and you're like, I get to watch the rest of this movie. This is great.
That's me at 5 in the morning last night, I had such a hard time because I knew I was coming on the show not tweeting it out. Like, I needed to tweet it out, but then I was like, I'll save it because you guys would have looked and known my moment.
Your fist pump?
Yeah.
You were that excited?
I was really excited because I forgot about it. I forgot about this moment. I watched it at 5 in the morning.
We're dedicated. It was like a couple hours ago.
A quick thing, though. I called my brother this morning to talk about this movie. I was like, do you remember when you watched it? He goes, I watched that literally 6 hours ago.
Really?
How weird is that? And I was like, it's destiny. I know we're supposed to talk talk about it today.
Is he going to see the show?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, good.
Oh, yeah. Shout out to Jet. Oh, he loves when I shout out. I never do it. Yeah, but so this was a... I'm stealing the light and I'm going to say my fist bump moment.
Do it. It better not be the same as mine.
No, it's not. It's definitely not. It's definitely not.
Do it. Come on.
I really don't think so. My favorite was the moment with the balloons. And as they're walking out of their escape room, and she's like, wait, and he like waits for nobody and waits for nothing. He's standing there, and you're like, "What exactly is going on?" And then the balloons come, and everybody looks over, and they're like, "Have you identified anybody?" And they're like, "No." I just thought that that was perfect and brilliant. The whole thing leading up to that, too, like he's going to drop his briefcase, all of that, because we know that they can predict murders, but we didn't know exactly how far things could go. I thought that was so awesome. And as the balloons came out, I was like, "Yes, Agatha."
It's one of those moments where you, because in this whole movie, you don't see Tom Cruise ever settle. Stop or be stagnant. And for it to be right in the middle of a chase for him to just have to stop. And I think it's mainly because it's Tom Cruise, too, to like see him have to just wait. He's not good at waiting for anything.
He runs a lot in this
movie. Runs a lot.
Oh, yeah. In every single movie. And he just, there's nothing he can do. Sometimes the best thing to do is stand still. And he is so bad at that. Like, I can feel the neurons in his butt kind of like racing back and forth. I love that moment.
That's great. Mine is when Colin Farrell has just figured out what's going on. He's like, the tides are going in, the tides are going out. He's like, these are two different murders.
Right.
Blah, 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 blah. And then Burge is sitting there. He's like, do you hear that? He's like, there's no, you know, there's no helicopters. There's no sirens. There's no. It's like, that's because no one knows this is going to happen, you know, whatever. And then he just shoots him in the chest.
Yeah.
And it's just like that moment of, holy shit. Like, this guy really is the smartest and the most
coldest.
Evil. He's just cold. He's just like, no one will get in the way of my vision. And he will kill anyone that gets in the way. And he knows how to manipulate the system better than anyone else.
He presents a really interesting character, Burgess, because that's a stereotype that is identifiable for most people, which is the much older, extremely successful guy who sort of should be retired.
Right.
You think he's retired.
Yeah, they even talk about it later on.
Yeah. But he's holding on to what his youth, sort of his younger years, all the glory that he had. Mm-hmm. And there's the sense from him, which is like, he's not willing to let go and just fade.
Right. He even says, like, this is, not only is this my legacy, this is John's legacy to his wife, you know?
Doing anything you can to stay alive, to stay relevant, to stay in the game, even when it's very clear you should have stepped down by now, you know?
And on the flip side of that, one of the reasons that I loved that moment so much was because of Colin Farrell's choices as an actor.
Yeah.
As he's falling down, and he almost kind of smiles like, oh my God, I was right.
Yeah.
But I just didn't get there, you know?
Yeah.
Because he comes in with this crazy thing, like, hear me out, and he was right.
And he totally redeems himself as a character.
Yeah.
Like, you pretty much hate him throughout the whole movie until that moment when you're like, he's just doing his job.
Absolutely.
Yeah, even just from the moment that he enters and he's in the temple. Gum? And he's is it in the temple or is it when he's going through it's when he's, like, doing his work and he's like, gum? He, like, jams his hand in. You're like, what are you doing, man?
Yeah.
Get out of here.
The other, on the flip side of that is the moment that Max has with the wife. When he's like, I'll have to check in the drowning, blah, blah, blah.
It's a good moment.
I never said that he drowned.
Yeah.
And then he just like stands up and he's like a foot taller than her.
Moves the chair to the side. Very like trying to physically intimidate her. Yeah.
It's like, well, I'll come over by the cottage tomorrow.
Yeah.
We'll finish the conversation. You're like, oh, dude.
Because now the precogs are back and he can't just stab her. But he would have. He totally would have.
He would have just killed her.
Yeah.
My two are the two kind of quiet emotional moments in the movie. And I like them both a lot. They're similar. They're like the same moment. But originally, I would say it's the scene where Cruz is doped up in his house watching the home movies of his gone son and his wife.
And he's saying all the lines.
And he's saying the lines, and like it's playing, and it's such a weird scene because he's super out of it, and it's super sad and kind of pathetic in a lot of ways because he's like, you're like, man, like you've watched this 100 times, and you're saying the lines with it. It's not really pathetic, it's the wrong word, but It's kind of disturbing.
It's devastating.
It's very sad. Yeah.
It's very eerie.
Real.
It's a weak moment. It's an extremely weak moment for his character. And then again, I would almost say that the moment later in the cottage when she says there was so much love in this house and all that, and then she goes through that whole monologue, that's a great scene.
Yeah.
That's my brother's favorite.
It's a great scene because then it ends with a creepy run,
which is really startling. Yeah, she just screams it.
Really startling. And I would almost say the second one's more touching. Like the second one, like, definitely got to me on an emotional level more. But the first one, there's just something about that first scene that is just very, like, because the opening to this movie is so
perfect,
frantic, and so quick, and such a great scene. And then it just, you take from this perfectly executed, I've stopped this murder, and I'm Tom Cruise, just like in control, to like, I'm going to just buy drugs in an alley and sit there watching home movies with my son. It's a total flip, you know, flips the crypts.
Yeah, so I got two things to say about one of them is more like, I'll just instead of just talking about it.
Yeah.
So the first one is that first 14 minutes of the movie is like essentially when we were watching, we were like, that's the whole movie. That's a trailer for the whole movie. And we were reading about it.
Yeah. What does 14 lead up to?
It's just the opening with them catching the Howard, whatever his name is, who's about to kill his wife. And it goes into him like doping up and watching movies with his kid.
So into the doors open, him going up and then, okay, got it.
So it's like the first 14 minutes of this movie is just like, it's a trailer for everything that's going to happen throughout this film. It's perfectly laid out, perfectly shot, and like the color and everything. You're like, I'm going on a ride here. This is going to be a different experience than I've had with other Spielberg movies.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I was going to ask you guys is that when Agatha is sitting there talking about what their son's life would have been.
Yeah.
Do you think that that's, what was his son's name? You guys remember?
Sean.
Sean. Do you think it was Sean's life, or do you think it's the kid that's in her belly at the end of the movie?
Oh, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
Because, I mean, she only can see things that are going to happen in the future.
She says Sean several times.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, and she also kept talking about how dead people are not gone and whatnot. So I think but I had such a tough time with that scene. I just think that the placement of it was so insane. Tough as in I thought it was beautiful. But the placement of it was so insane because she can see the future and she knows that everybody's coming right now. And she chooses this moment before she says run to lead up to this. Like she knows he's screwed. If she says run before she goes through this, he gets out of there and he gets out safe.
Let me tell you a story.
Yeah. You know what I think? The reason that I think that happens, and I think sort of the herd being taken by surprise in that moment to have that whole monologue before she says run, I think the reason it happens is because she's been locked up in this temple for years, right? And she's been seeing murder after murder after murder after murder. And now she's had this shock to her system for the last, you know, day where she's driving around, she's walking to shopping mall, stuff that she hasn't experienced in forever. Totally shocked. And she finds herself now awake in a peaceful place, filled with love. And I think she's kind of she's giving that, like, monologue almost as much for her sake as she is for theirs.
Right, because she's getting to see something beautiful for the first
time. Exactly, and that's why I think she gets to it, and then she's like, you're going to have to run again. Like, all of a sudden, she's like, oh God, I'm back to negative.
Mm-hmm.
Run, and that's why I think she has that reaction. That scene is definitely, like, the one in the movie that, like, you know, you get a little teary-eyed almost, because it's just, the only part about that scene that I, like, lost it a little is when Cruz is, like, collapsing and crying, like, it wasn't that it was bad. It just was a little bit more than I needed. Just a little more than I needed. I almost would have just rather had more just time on her talking. I didn't even really necessarily need to see his much more than maybe one or two moments of his reaction. Mm-hmm. But that's small. I don't know.
Right.
I see what you're saying, but I think that in terms of his character, we needed to see that, especially when we see what he's like when he thinks he found the killer. It was kind of that similar, like, something's taken over my body. This isn't who I am usually.
Right.
So I enjoyed that moment.
I also love the last one is when he's crying, given that you have the right to remain silent. He's holding
That's against the Okro.
Yeah.
So good. Amazing.
Just awesome. Broken.
I really wish I could watch this movie for the first time again.
Oh.
Like, I need to find somebody who hasn't seen it.
I didn't see this movie when it came out in theaters. I think I saw it like about 4 or 5 years later, like maybe like 2006. And I definitely just remember watching it and being like, this movie was great.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why don't people talk about this movie?
Mm-hmm.
Sort of, which is sort of our whole point. But anyway, we've been harping for a while. We started to actually talk a little bit about the Cruise career around this time. And that's exactly what we're going to get into right now with Star Profiles. So we should talk a little bit about, this is where we can talk about the sort of phases of the career. So if you look at the 90s and you think of basically Risky Business in the 80s goes into Oscar supporting character in Rain Man and Color of Money. Born on the 4th of July gets the Oscar nod in the late 80s, right? He's no longer sort of a kid. The early 90s, now he's like this action leading man guy with Few Good Men and Days of Thunder, movies like that. But by the mid 90s, by 95, he's now achieved everything. He's Mission Impossible 1 comes out. He's the guy. He's an action star, his own brand, his own production company. And the next year, Jerry Maguire, he gets the lead actor, you know, the lead actor nomination. No longer as a kid where it's surprising in Born on the 4th of July, but as a straight up leading man.
Yeah, and also just the longevity of it, that this wasn't like a fleeting thing, that he's been in the game for a long time at this point.
Now Cruise has been relevant for 12, 13 years.
Right.
Yeah. So when this movie happens, this is 6 years after Jerry Maguire. And in that 6 years, what happened was he goes, okay, I'm going to win this Oscar. So it's like Magnolia with Paul Thomas Anderson. He's a supporting character in 98. Eyes Wide Shut in 1997. Magnolia's in 99. You know, Mission Impossible 2 is the sort of the obligatory sequel in 2000, but Vanilla Sky, which is the heady remake of Over Los Ojos, the original, I can't remember who made the original movie, but it's a Spanish film, but it's Cameron Crowe trying to make this, like, sort of psychological thing.
Weird movie.
Yeah, and these are the movies that he's doing in the late 2000s, and I think when he lost for Magnolia in 99...
That's when he kind of was like, I feel like he didn't give up, but he's like, I need to take my career in a different direction for a while.
Yeah, because when this movie comes out, and I read in all the press lead up to it, he's turning 40 3 weeks after the press tour for this movie was taking place. And he kept saying in the interviews, I'm fine with it. And I sort of feel like he was like, you know what? The most successful thing I've done is make action films. I'm an action movie guy. And that's when his company's like, okay, let's put Mission Impossible 3 in the works. You know, let's put Last Samurai in the works. Let's really get this going. And that's good.
I was going to say, his best moments in action movies come from his dramatic background.
Yeah.
MI3, Last Samurai, the moments in that, the moments in Collateral, and the moments in this movie that are so real and raw and, like, visceral. Mm-hmm. That's what makes these movies. That's what makes him one of the greatest, if not the greatest, action hero of all time, is that he has that vulnerability that you miss so much that makes him so relatable.
Yeah, and also the fact that it's not just he has this realization that this is what he does best at or people appreciate most. Unlike most people, as you guys talk about all the time, he does all of his own stunts, so that's very fulfilling for him. It's not like he's sitting there, he's popping his face, and somebody else is coming in and doing all the work. Right. This is something that he loves to do, that Spielberg actually fought him consistently on, like taking it back and toning it back. And I think that that is way more fulfilling. If that's something you love to do, it's not like you're just a face on this poster. You're really going in there and your entire body is transforming, your mind, everything you're learning. So it's different than most action stars.
It's really funny you say that, because we'll show it a little later, but we have like a behind the scenes stunts thing in this movie. And Spielberg, in one of the bits, is talking. He's like, all the high jumps off the scaffolds, you know, Cruise is doing that stuff himself. He's like, and I just, it's really impressive. And like, the difference between him like jumping off of like scaffolds with a rope in like 2002
to what he was
doing in 2014, 2011 is like, he just took it. It was like, I'm just going to, you know, hang from an airplane, hold my breath for 6 minutes, jump off the Burj Khalifa, fall 20 feet.
Spielberg would have never let him do that though, if he directed the movies. Cause he was like, even saying, he's like, I can't sleep at night if I'm worried that Tom is going to get hurt tomorrow.
Right.
I pick what stunts he does and what he doesn't do.
And Cruise was like, we're not working together anymore. I'm making the movie. I'm the producer and I'm going to do what I want.
That's right.
So that's actually what happened. That's why they don't make movies together anymore.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. It's nuts. But anyway, we talked too much about Cruise.
Let's get into Colin Farrell. This is incredibly interesting with Colin Farrell and where his career is at. This is the beginning of the pinnacle of Colin Farrell's career.
Yeah, like the turning point in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I saw American Outlaws in theaters. I'm just going to say that right now, 2001. It's not a good movie.
Yeah, no.
It's a bad movie.
Not a good movie. Parts War is also not a very good movie.
Also bad. And Phone Booth.
Roxy loves it.
I love Phone Booth. I love Phone Booth. It's not that long. It was, I thought, really exciting. We didn't go that many places. We stuck around a phone booth for most of it.
When you say it's not that long, that's the glowing review?
No, I'm just saying, like, it knew what it was. It was something that was short, and it was a thriller, and people were watching it because they started to like him, and I thought that he did a very good job at it.
That's like being like, look, sugar-free frozen yogurt, it doesn't get me that fat. I mean, it's okay. It's
not like that at all.
I like that about it.
Because most people are like, oh, I don't want to see a movie that takes place in a phone booth and sit there for 3 hours. It's not that long, so it's more exciting.
It's great. It's fair.
So he goes and he does American Outlaws, then he does Hearts War, and then Phone Booth is released later in this year. But, you know. And then he does this movie, and then he goes on to just being the guy.
For a few years, he's the guy, right?
He does The Recruit immediately with Al Pacino, and he goes into doing Daredevil with Ben Affleck, flop, horrible. SWAT, and then At Home at the End of the World. I remember seeing previews for that. I never watched it.
I didn't see it either.
Alexander, The New World, didn't see, you know, Acid Dust, Miami Vice. Like, he's the guy. He's the guy that sells the tickets.
New World's pretty good. Miami Vice is pretty bad.
Yeah. And then he does In Bruges, which is one of my favorite movies.
Love In Bruges.
I never thought of him as the guy, and I still don't think of him as the guy. I think of him as a guy.
But his career is like, it's one of those funny careers, because all the movies you name, the huge budget ones that he's involved in for the most part in there, he's not the guy on the poster where you're like, I'm going to see this movie because Colin Farrell's in it.
That's what the guy means to me.
I think that that's who he was at the time in his career. Even if he's not the biggest name on it, he's still the guy. Like, you go and see him in the movie.
In the movie, and it's like his movie.
Yeah, I think he's incredible. I think he's very talented. I really like his work, but I've never saw something or been walking down the street and somebody's like, ooh, that's a Colin Farrell movie. I have to go see that because I love Colin Farrell.
Well, True Detective Season 2, he's the best part of the whole thing.
Because he's very talented.
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't see The Recruit because Al Pacino in 2003.
True.
That's not why you watched that movie.
Right, his career was on
the outs. In SWAT and...
But you think you watched it because of Colin Farrell?
That's why I watched it.
I mean, what I was going to say is when you say the guy, what I take that as, and my agreement with you on that is, he's... Okay, being cast as Bullseye is the classic. That's the one, that's the most indicative to me. Because when you're making a superhero property and it's going to be a big budget movie, and you need a guy who's like, yeah, we trust this guy's chops. He can carry a villain in a superhero movie with a bunch of green screen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Colin Farrell's hot. He's a guy that can do that. That's where I'm like,
right.
You know what I'm saying?
Because he's talented. He's a very talented actor, but that's why you have huge names surrounding him also. He's not the only big name in that universe.
In SWAT or in Alexander,
I mean, in any of these things.
In Miami Vice. I think, in my opinion, when you get included in a, like, the follow-up that Michael Mann makes to Collateral, that means you're the guy. But it's different than being like Tom Cruise or like Brad Pitt as the guy, right?
Yeah.
But
he's still like
what's a level under the guy then? Like
1B or something?
Just guy?
he was the guy.
Yeah.
He was one of the guys in Hollywood at the time.
100%, 100%. If guy says he's the guy, then he's the guy.
A guy says he's the guy.
100%. Like if you're thinking about the stretch between 02 and like 08, it's like who are the sort of like top three or top five males that we're going to throw into prominent roles in big, big movies?
Right.
He's one of those guys.
Absolutely.
So totally. I agree with you there.
He's one of those guys. We can all agree on that.
But I think we can all agree that he never transitioned from that guy into like the Brad Pitt or the Matt Damon or like...
It's because of what happened in this run. He was supposed to do that. I really feel like he was supposed to do that with his career, and he just couldn't do it. There was too many bad movies in there.
Yeah, he's just not... There's just something about him. Like I almost feel like what he did with True Detective Season 2 is almost more what he's suited for.
I think what he did in Bruges is like one of his best roles.
Incredible.
And it has nothing to do with lack of talent.
Yeah.
No, not at all.
Oh, he's almost like too... He's too interesting. He's not like just like generic and American enough. He's like, there's some like... I don't know. I guess, you know who he didn't... If they had remade Lethal Weapon 7 years ago, he would have been Riggs.
Yeah.
How many times when you guys are doing recasting have you used him as the recast?
Never. Not for me, anyway.
What does that have to do with anything?
Just the rest of the guys you have used.
He's just a tiny bit older than he needs to be for
those
roles.
I've only used Brad Pitt once, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe.
But that's an interesting point, actually. I wouldn't be surprised if he shows up more.
I'm sure
he will. Now he's going to come up every week.
Every week. All right, let's move on because we are... I have no idea what time it is, but I know that we
it's time
are...
time for us to talk about... production.
Going hard right now.
Yes.
Let's talk about my Minority Report production notes and who wrote it and produced it and directed it and this huge amount of outline that we wrote. Where do we want to start? Let's start with directing Spielberg.
Why not? Spielberg, you know?
We haven't done a Spielberg movie yet, so...
Which is not that surprising because of the movies that he does, but it's like, I wish we would have talked about Spielberg already, but we get to now.
I don't know that Spielberg has another movie we would do unless we decided to do War of the Worlds, but... Ooh.
You would have to do one of the earlier Jurassic Parks, because then you'd have to bring Roxy back.
What happened? We talked about Jurassic 1.
Yeah, we talked about Jurassic 1. I've talked about Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah. Hard to pigeonhole those movies into this genre.
Yeah.
I guess you could say the same thing about this movie, but the fact that it's like Cruise is an action hero, and you kind of have... It just feels the most like it.
I mean, what he did for this... So when he went in and he talked to his old... cinematographer from Schindler's List from Saving Private Ryan. He's like, I want to do something darker, grittier, and uglier than anything we've ever done.
Right.
And he's going to do it with Tom Cruise. And this is the first time they'd ever worked together.
Yeah.
Do you feel like he accomplished that?
Absolutely. I mean, this movie is gnarly. This movie's gnarly. Like, the color, the city, just like how dirty it is. You've got the no-eyed man. You've got the eye surgery. You've got them just carrying around eyeballs and stepping on them. It's just, it's not the type of movie that these guys do. Like, for what Steven Spielberg did with action-adventure movies, Indiana Jones, Jurassic Park, this is a complete step away from what his traditional action genre was.
And yeah, if you talk about the other movies in the sci-fi territory within a couple years of it, you know, The Matrix coming to mind is the other most prominent, huge one, and then Equilibrium, obviously, was within about a year of that. This is totally different. This is like, if The Matrix is a weird sort of alternate reality where we're plugged in, and if we look at Equilibrium is sort of like the dystopian utopian future, but if you look
that movie,
yeah, Equilibrium's great.
Yeah.
But you look at this movie, this nothing about this movie is trying to be way beyond something that could happen, aside from obviously the precogs, which is just absurd. Right. But I mean, but in terms of any of the design, so much of the design was intentionally supposed to feel real. That's why I think this movie stands up well, and why at the time when it came out, there was this really kind of shocking quality to it. Like everything, I mean, there's a ton written about. A lot of the stuff Spielberg concepted for this movie, you know, he had this thing that was called...
It was a think tank.
Yeah, think tank, right? Yeah. And I think they called it like the Minority Report Summit or something like that. And he brought in basically 7 or 8 minds, all these like MIT architecture, you know...
People from Apple.
Mechanical engineers, chemical scientists, like these all different people. And he had this weekend in Santa Monica for 3 days where there's like an 80-page, essentially like a Bible of all these ideas they came up to make this world plausible. And a ton of the things they came up with in the movie in 2002 or 2001 when they were concepting it have come true.
Yeah, they come to fruition. They're real things now.
Yeah, I mean, there's and a lot of these products, like they're still products that are being worked on. If you think about something like, you know, direct advertising via retinal scans and all that,
they're working on that now still for facial recognition scans to do.
And you think about, you know, and your IP address being used to recognize your preferences online for things you're searching for, and then your Facebook feed pops up. You know, you search for this thing, here's 5 options. It's all kind of the same type of thing. So I think that's really interesting as a director. I almost feel like that's the most relevant part of his direction, is his insistence that this movie would feel and look that way. There's also the visual design, which is totally his.
Yeah, the only thing... is the cars being on tracks that we're still, like, who knows how far away from? Everyone has the same cars. They're all on tracks. They all move in motion through, like, a bigger system.
Because old cars just wouldn't function on that, right. So it seems crazy.
Yeah. And then, like, but even the newspaper with, like, the moving ads and like, the refreshable ads, is Xerox and a company in Japan are still working on making something like this.
And how different is that from a tablet that is automatically updating as you're reading the newspaper, the news, yeah?
Right, and we'll get there about the writing, too, but I think that Spielberg, all the things you're talking about, if it wasn't for him, this movie wouldn't have been a good movie. If he didn't insist on bringing those minds in. Yeah. If he didn't insist on the realistic aspect of the future. If he didn't insist on rewrites or whatever it is, I think this movie would have totally flopped. So because of his pre-production work, that's why this movie works for me at least.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Cameron could have done it? Cameron?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it would have
been
a little different.
2002 is when this was.
No, what year would Cameron
have done it? I mean, this is when he was like swimming underwater in Aliens of the Deep. Because I think Cameron's big break was 07 to... Avatar, right? He didn't do a movie other than Aliens of the Deep between Avatar and Titanic.
I don't think that he at the time would have been able to do what Spielberg did.
Fair.
Maybe.
I think he would do a good job with this movie.
Yeah, I mean, Cameron's like he took all that time to switch from practical to like CGI. And like I said, he was underwater looking at Aliens of the Deep at the time, which is awesome if you guys haven't seen that movie.
Absolutely.
But anyway, yeah, I think that this is a success on Spielberg's part. I also think it's interesting that he insisted he and Cruise both take 15% of gross income on the film as opposed to actually taking any money up front.
Which is when you believe in a movie.
Yeah.
Right, which is what he always says. He's like, if the movie's not going to make any money, I don't make any money.
Right.
And I believe in that wholeheartedly.
Yeah, yeah. So I definitely think that it's interesting that in 1992 this movie was originally optioned, because it's based on a Philip K. Dick short story originally, and it sort of, like a lot of the movies we end up researching, went through many, many iterations. It was optioned in 92. He ended up getting delayed working on Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Mm-hmm. Cruise, a few years later, ended up getting held up working on Mission Impossible 2, while Jean DuBont, who... is credited as a producer, but had zero to do with the movie.
Nothing at all.
Was originally
happens all the time.
Yeah, he was supposed to direct the film after Speed, which was in 94. In 97, he was supposed to direct it. He ended up actually not doing anything with it. So it took a few years. You know, Spielberg, because of the death of Kubrick, ended up finishing AI for Kubrick, which pushed this movie back even further, which is how we get it in 1998.
AI? 2001 Space Odyssey? AI? Was it AI that Kubrick
What did I just say?
You said... AI.
Yeah, Kubrick was working on AI, and then he died during production, and Spielberg finished it.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah. It's why that's such a weird movie, because it's 50-50, or it's like 70-30. It's like Kubrick did 70% of
it. I still like that movie.
That's weird, because back in 1990, when they were originally, or 92, when they were going to originally do this, it was, what were the names? Ronald Shusett and Gary Goldman
they'd written it as a sequel to Total Recall.
Right, because it's another Philip K. Dick.
Right, yeah. And that got washed over the years, and then Cruise like presented him with this script. He's like, what do you think about this movie? And Spielberg's like, I'm not going to do it until I see a script that I like.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot. When we talk about writing, we can just sort of jump into it. There's a lot of different drafts because the original story is short and mm-hmm. doesn't really have a second or third act. Right. It's just a brief idea, and the characters are all very different. The Anderton character is sort of a late 40s, early 50s, out of shape, single man with no family.
Balding,
and his assistant is essentially the Colin Farrell character.
Whitworth, yeah.
Who kind of tries to usurp him by framing him for murder.
Well, that's what he thinks happens.
Okay.
So what happens originally is that instead of Leo Crow being the guy that he's supposed to kill, he sees it's this guy named General Kaplan,
okay,
I believe, who is going to use pre-crime as... He's going to use it for evil, essentially, is what you get out of it.
Right.
So what happens in the original story is that Cruz Anderton goes on this mission to find him, and he does, and he kills him consciously. So he... And the same thing as him killing Leo Crow with indirectly or not meaning to. He kills the guy consciously and then is... exiled to some random frontier planet with his wife, and then Whitworth takes over.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
So it's very different, but I do understand. Like, Burgess wasn't even in the story at all. He was completely created just for the film.
For the film.
Yeah.
There were so many different drafts, as you mentioned, and I think that everything you guys have talked about, what they did was they took the best parts of each, yeah. Like the car scene or whatever, and all the different drafts, which is a really risky play, because a lot of times if you take the best part of all different scripts, they don't go well together, and right. it's not cohesive.
Right.
It worked out for them in their favor, probably because Spielberg had so much experience and is a great director and knew what he was doing and surrounded himself with people that he trusted. But I was kind of surprised hearing like this came from that and this came from that and this right. came from that, and knowing that all these things were such separate original concepts, I'm glad it worked out.
Yeah,
could
I mean,
have
Spielberg
really gone
was,
differently.
He was elated when Cruz was when production went over on MI2 so that he could bring in what's the guy's name, John August, who did some uncredited stuff, and Scott Frank.
Yeah,
they did the final revisions of Scott Cohen's script.
Well, because there's like seven, if you include Philip K. Dick, I think there's like seven writers.
Right.
Something like that.
It's absurd.
Yeah. I mean, and the movie flows well, you know. But, and this is not one of those, this is like not one of those situations, like so many of the movies we end up doing on the show, where we find out that they went into production with a script that was like 30% done, and they were just writing it on the fly.
Right. And this is also a different time. It's not like social media. Every single day somebody's saying, another writer was added to this, and everybody is like, this movie's going to suck. There wasn't a lot of negative press going into this because of all of those changes and because of the slow process. I think today, if this had happened, I think it would have gotten a way smaller box office opening weekend.
Sure.
Because there was just a lot of different writers and things
right.
going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, in that sense, when you talk about the negative press, one thing that comes to mind, it's funny, we talk about this as if it's like sort of Cruise's return to action. If you think about this movie in the sense that it's a piece of art from Steven Spielberg, it's a dramatic performance from Cruise, and it comes on the heels of the dramatic stretch. It's almost like really The Last Samurai is his return. This is the pivot point. But you almost could movie. You could almost think about this movie as more of an art, like an art house movie. It's just very interesting. It sort of straddles both. But anyway, the producers we could talk a little about. Jan de Bont was
not
originally
really a producer,
not a producer at all, and he's relevant to us because he was a Dutch cinematographer that worked on a ton of movies mm-hmm. that we have done on the show. I mean, he was a cinematographer for Die Hard, for The Hunt for Red October, for Lethal Weapon 3. You know, very well respected, worked with Paul Verhoeven, the sort of weird, like satirical auteur guy who Starship Troopers and all these weird movies over the years, Showgirls. He ended up directing Speed in 1994. He was supposed to direct Godzilla and didn't. And
right.
he was supposed to direct this movie and didn't. And now he's a producer on the movie. So
yeah, it's funny because Shusett and Goldman, I think with the original writers of the original script, I think after their Writers Guild, like
yeah.
whatever, other dispute, they also got producer credits. There's three producers on this movie that literally had nothing to do with it.
You wonder what that even entails. Like, did they make any money? Is it just
right.
name on the
probably
movie?
Just billing, yeah.
Yeah.
It's very Oprah-esque. Producer credit for you. You
right.
get a producer
yeah.
credit.
right. So, Bonnie Curtis, as noted, I mean, we're just going to kind of rattle through the producers quickly here because frankly, it doesn't add that much to our critical discussion of
the movie.
I don't
think that's why you guys watch the show, but...
But congratulations
to them. It's something we care about.
Yeah. So Bonnie Curtis is someone who sort of... She's like a... She's a 50-50 career person. Her first half of her career is almost exclusively with Spielberg. Huge movies with him. You know, her earliest stuff, like, you know, with him, I believe. She worked on this movie. She worked on... what the hell else? Her earliest starring was with Spielberg. Starring with Spielberg's assistant in 2017. Well, I don't have it written here. Do you remember what I wrote down for Bonnie Curtis?
Why don't we talk about that something else?
And I'll look Dead Poets Society.
Yeah, production work on those movies. If you want to look it up, I'll talk about Walter F. Parks. So he's a guy who we just researched a few weeks ago for the Gladiator episode. I don't want to say any producer that's worked on big movies is middling, because it's we go in terms of, like, if you're Bruce Berman or Joel Silver or someone like that, you're the biggest. Then if you're not, and you're not somebody who just directs or produces indies, then you're sort of middling, which is what a lot of these guys are. And so Walter F. Parks, I mean, some of the movies he's worked on, you know, Twister, Amistad, Men in Black, Gladiator, that's pretty big stuff.
Yeah, those are big movies. She did AI.
There you go.
Lost World, Saving Private Ryan.
Those are the ones. Yeah.
Oh, all with Spielberg on it.
Yeah, so she did that. And then the second half of her career after she sort of split off. A lot of sort of art house festival movies with big actors, though. Not the kind that where you see it's a bunch of foreign actors or, or one star that you do. It's like pretty big people and stuff that's still coming out now. Right. So she's still very much in the game, but her style seems to be a little different. She's not really as interested in the big blockbusters.
Her
now.
First five movies she ever produced were The Lost World, Amistad, Saving Private Ryan, AI, and Minority Report.
Exactly.
Woman power. Yeah. Right?
That's incredible.
Yeah, she worked with Spielberg for 17 years. So
it's a really nice song.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
And then lastly was Gerald R. Mullen. And it's very interesting about him. He's a guy that worked on Minority Report, Rain Man, Schindler's List, Twister, right? So he's actually related to every producer on this list in some way.
Right.
Just in the movies.
All of them.
Just in the movies that he produced. And then basically Minority Report was sort of the end of that run. He took a big break and he came back to producing documentaries in 2011, which appears he still is doing, but he's not really involved in the big budget stuff anymore.
Right.
So that pretty much covers producers. We can
cool. And just talk about dollars.
Yeah. So this is pretty cool, I think. This movie cost $100 million to make, right?
Yep.
102. $40 million advertising budget. It grossed 132 and another 226 worldwide. So 140 against 358.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good numbers.
And that's with your leading star and your massive director not getting paid.
Right.
Out of the initial budget.
Yeah.
Which is why they did that, to keep it at $100 or $100 million. $100 for this movie.
So if this cost 140 and it made 358, Edge of Tomorrow, by contrast, cost $175, but they spent an additional $100 million on marketing.
Right.
And that movie only ended up making about $335 worldwide, if I remember correctly.
Right.
$350, $340, something like that. So the difference, the huge difference, is the advertising budget.
Massive.
Massive. And I think that this movie only finished 17th in 2002. I mean, there's a ton of movies that finished ahead of it. It barely beat Lilo and Stitch in its opening weekend. That's crazy. Lilo and Stitch.
Well, that means family.
Yeah. Family means we stay together.
Oh my God! But the voice—you got to do it.
The voice.
Family means no one gets left behind.
Okay. Cruz incidentally actually auditioned for the role of Stitch,
but Roxy beat him out for it.
Listen, family means no one's left behind.
Ohana means family.
Can you guys like? I felt like I needed like a clap for me or something. Wasn't it
pretty good
Stitch?
Yeah.
You did a good job. It was a good Stitch. It was good. Yeah, which is funny because Lilo and Stitch sold more tickets, but they were children's tickets, so it didn't make as much money.
Yeah, it is pretty funny.
Damn children, grow
damn
up.
Damn kids.
Buy your own tickets.
I mean, this movie opened number one with 35.6, but what, Lilo and Stitch made 35.26?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, like...
And then this movie dropped off pretty quickly.
I mean, that should be pretty indicative of what we're talking about, is like, if you think about a movie like Lilo and Stitch,
mm-hmm.
like in the canon of movies that mattered in the last 20 years... Did Lilo and Stitch matter in this as a dramatic film in the same way that Minority Report
matters?
As a
dramatic film? We're comparing it as a dramatic film?
Wrong context. Nowadays, do people look back on Lilo and Stitch fondly the same way they look back on Minority Report? I feel like Lilo and Stitch was like a...
It could be the same conversation.
Lilo and Stitch was pretty huge.
When you're like, did you see Minority Report? Oh yeah, that movie's great. Do you remember Lilo and Stitch? Oh, I love that movie.
Okay,
you
fair enough. I mean? Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's just demographic then.
No, I don't think you're wrong because there's a clear preference for one, but I think that Lilo and Stitch is pretty, it's got like a lot of fans.
Yeah, it's funny. Lilo and Stitch, I have a very sour memory. I went to see with my girlfriend in
eighth or ninth grade. I can't remember which one I was
in. She broke up with you?
We got in a fight halfway through it, so I just went and sat in the lobby.
Doesn't sound like you at all.
No, no, no.
Did you ever see the end of the movie?
No, never seen the end of it. I will not. And I will not see it. I will not see it. And I hate you.
You gotta see it and cover it on Action Movie Anatomy because it totally fits all four things.
Special edition. Will you come in dressed up as the orange thing?
The orange thing?
I didn't know if it was Lilo or Stitch, so I just had to say the orange thing.
The blue
Lilo,
thing.
Lilo's the girl, and Stitch is blue, and what is orange? All right. Yes, I'll come in as the orange.
Just dress up as an orange blob and
do Lilo and Stitch.
Just come in and Stitch with my orange thing.
I'll bring you an orange plush blanket you can put on.
I'm like really impressed with myself, and you guys don't seem to be impressed with
very,
myself.
We're very, even someone just now said no love for Roxy. What is with that?
Look, we love Roxy. We were in the middle of doing Tom Cruise impersonations.
Yeah.
Can we just acknowledge that?
I can't
can
do my Cruise. My Cruise isn't as good. My Stitch and my Yoda are pretty good, although Yoda sounds like Stitch, and you can't hear it
now.
Now
we got to hear Yoda.
Nope. You're going to have to ask me on again.
If you just watch Marvel Movie News, you'll be able to hear her.
Anyway.
So, let's take a quick look here at the Philip K. Dick adaptations that have made money, and we can sort of see an order here. Total Recall is number one, and Minority Report, the original sequel to Total Recall, is number two.
Right.
After that,
Blade Runner. And that is the original Total Recall, by the way, guys, as you can see.
As you can see, after Adjustment, after this is awful, the remake in 2012 starring Colin Farrell.
Right. Our boy.
No money. Adjustment Bureau Paycheck. Man, these are some bad movies.
Paycheck is wonderful.
I mean, pretty much you've got one, two, and three are all sweet. Yeah. And then 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10.
They're all bad.
Are all bad? Is Imposter the one with Gary Sinise? Is that right?
I think so.
It is, right?
I don't want you guys to quote me on that, but I'm pretty positive that's the one.
Pretty sure it's like one of those movies where like I was like, oh my God, I love movies about this like in sci-fi futures where your identity is somehow mistaken and you have to escape from a prison. Then I watched 12 minutes of it, and I was like, oh, this is terrible.
Yeah.
I can't do this. And then, you know, Blade Runner, the reissue, and that's not really fair to call that a bad movie.
No, not at all.
It's a good film.
That's the reissuing.
Okay. Yes. Anyway. So, and critically, this movie, people love this movie.
Yeah. It's crazy.
They forget about it. But yeah, critically, I mean, this movie is a 7.7 on IMDb, which is, that's always good for an action movie.
Yeah, I think it should be higher, but.
I do too, actually. I actually thought it would be closer to 8.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I wonder about?
Hmm.
I wonder if you were to take every Cruise movie, which I think at this point is like 42 or something like that.
Like you wonder this when you're sleeping, like about to go to bed
when
at night.
When you're looking at your poster.
Yeah, when you're kissing the...
Hey, Tom. It's not on my ceiling, guys.
It's not when you wonder.
It's not on my ceiling anymore. It fell down!
It's not a thing. I'm sorry, Tom. I'm sorry. You know what I wonder is if you were to take all Cruise movies and you were to look at what the aggregate IMDb score is as well as the all critics score on all of them.
All the way across the board.
I wonder where this movie would rank. Because
for all of his movies, rank-wise.
Yeah, okay. Because I feel like there's a lot of movies that are on those lists that would rank really high that most people like don't just jump and talk about.
Right.
Like Rain Man comes to mind.
Magnolia is one that people wouldn't think about for him to be
Color
like
of Money. I feel like some people
Jerry
might.
Jerry Maguire. You know.
Interview with the Vampire probably ranks pretty high. Like there's a bunch of movies.
Rock of Ages.
Oh God.
Wait, what?
Andrew, we have a replacement host for you. He's outside.
Guys, thank you.
No. Another movie I actually really enjoyed.
True story, guys. I'm a huge fan of hair metal. Grew up, and my older brother got me into it. I was in a band. I had a nickname, Tommy Guns.
I wish we had the picture of Ben in his hair
metal. Can you post
it?
Can you post that somewhere?
If you find me on Instagram, you can see some pretty ridiculous pictures. But the funny part about this is that we all know Tom Cruise is basically, next to Patrick Swayze, my favorite actor of all time. And hair metal is my favorite genre of music of all time. I've never seen Rock of Ages. Boom. That just happened.
Boom.
So let's
keep
going.
That's changing so fast.
I thought that the audience score might be a little higher. I mean, 80% is obviously great.
Yeah.
But for some reason, like, if all critics give it a 90, I would have expected the audience to be closer to 90.
Mm-hmm.
But again, not a big deal. 80% is still great.
Yeah.
That's what Cruise told himself after looking at that. It's not a big deal.
Have you ever listened to his interviews? He doesn't do movies for money. He doesn't care at all.
He doesn't need to make money.
Yeah. He just does movies because he wants to do them, which is why he's making Jack Reacher 2.
Yeah, he's totally fine just being poor. Oh, wait, he doesn't need to make money because he's already a multimillionaire.
He never did anything for money.
Did you listen to him on Inside the Actors Studio?
All right.
James Lipton is a good friend of his. I interviewed James Lipton recently about Tom Cruise.
Is the greatest actor of all time.
If you guys go to Black Hollywood Live on YouTube and you look up
the
Creative Arts Emmys, you can see interviews from that event. And I talked to Lipton about Cruise. And I was like, sir, I'm a huge fan of your show. You know, I just recently actually watched the Tom Cruise episode. which was, anyway, he's like, that one was a beaut. And I was like, yeah, I was so impressed with your ability to weave, you know, amusing anecdotes into really hard hitting questions. What do you believe? What do you have to say to the notion that there are no longer movie stars, that we're in a new era with no movies? And he goes, Tom Cruise. That's my answer. Tom Cruise is my answer to that question. I was like, you and I have something in common. Sorry,
and you popped a little male boner there, yeah.
Which is pretty great.
as opposed to a large female boner.
I don't know. I'm just so used to saying lady boner.
Right.
What just happened, Rox?
Male boner.
We'll just get into reviews and we'll act like that never happened.
That guy gives me a male boner. What are you talking about?
All right, so Susan Stark from the Detroit. What is happening this week?
Can we actually change fist pump moment to male boner moment?
But little. It has to be a little male boner. But
little male boner?
Yeah.
That's very funny. I'm making a note of that. Keep talking.
I drew one on my paper. Susan Stark, Detroit News. Cold and scattered. Minority Report commands interest almost solely as an exercise in gorgeous visuals. That's not vintage Spielberg, and that finally is minimally satisfying.
Really? Yeah, it doesn't really seem... Like, cold and scattered, almost like analog to, like, chrome reflective and constantly moving, right? It's, like, almost the same thing.
But what is your... Like...
It's not even the harshest,
the point
though.
Of the movie.
Yeah.
You know? Like, if what you're noticing about the movie is just, like, the production design, essentially, or, like, the set design,
yeah.
The costuming, that means those guys did their job. Now let's actually talk about the movie.
I like
the acting.
I like the other one you wrote here, the fresh review from Anne from Washington Post, which Steven Spielberg creates a ghastly, frightening world in Minority Report, a world light or rather dark years ahead from the honeyed allegories and adventures he made earlier in his career. I think that's a great review.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. Yeah, that was one of my... There's a lot of very good reviews for this movie, and that was the one that hit home the most for me.
Because of what we do here, because I'm interested, I watch a lot of YouTube reviews, and I saw somebody who spent 10 minutes talking about the fact that this movie... couldn't be a movie because it makes no sense that if he saw what he did in the future, he never would have done it, and then we never would have seen it, so there wouldn't have been a movie. And like looking into that so much that they were so pissed about the movie they couldn't even like get through it. I think that is so ridiculous when people take this genre of film and
that's also a failed analysis of the movie, because the only reason he even ends up where Leo Crow is because he's running. And he's running from getting caught for a murder he didn't commit yet.
Because he found
out. He would have never been in that position. He would have never been in that mall. He would have never been in that part of town. He would have never seen that skyscraper to where he would have gotten there. So it's one of those things. And this movie, when we did research on this movie, there is more written about this movie than any movie we've ever done.
Is that true?
Which is shocking.
Wow. Let's do it, yeah.
There are literally like 15 pages, if you were to print it out, if not more, about just... the theories that go behind this movie and like fate versus choice and like if he would have ever been in that position, you know, and it's all very fascinating. And obviously we would like to talk about it a lot, but I honestly think you guys should go and read about it because they do a better job.
Yeah,
there's too much.
I should take a second to just point out actually that on top of that, when we were talking about the Philip K. Dick story and we were relating it, I didn't read the story. I'm assuming you didn't read the story. We
read about the story. Yes.
As far as the history of this and anything that has, so same with The Matrix, the mythology or the history or the relativity of the stuff we're talking about is not something that we are speaking on. So if you know more than we do, feel free to comment, tweet at us, and let us know. We're not trying to sit here like experts about that stuff. It's just not what the show's about. It just needs to be pointed out. Right. So
it's fascinating, but that is not what we do here.
Yes. I do want to say, though, as far as the criticisms of this film go, there's one thing that you run into with science fiction left, right, and center, and that is basically... the chicken or the egg nature of alternate universes, realities, or timelines. So the concept in time travel, any of the Terminator movies, if you were to go back in time to change the future, you would cease to exist. Do you create a separate reality that splits off? I mean, there's all the theories that people talk about, and it's very difficult. You'll never find... you can't make sense of it. There's no perfect way to make sense
of it. There's no answer.
Yeah, it is a 100% chicken or the egg, and it will always be that way. So I do think that there's like that sense of, you know, destiny versus changed fate. The one thing that I have to say about this, though, and I thought about this right at the beginning of the movie, and Cruise almost answers the question in a later scene just before he kills Crow, is he finds out he's going to kill someone, and he believes that he's innocent, right? He believes that he's not going to do it.
Right.
But my question is, he says later in the film, I've spent 6 years imagining two things, what my son would look like now, would I recognize him, and what I would do to the man who took him. So he knows from the get-go, there's only one person he would willingly kill. someone who had to do with the death of his son.
Right.
He knows this.
So if he knows he killed somebody, why doesn't he put two and two together?
My feeling is as soon as he realizes that he's going to kill someone, how does he not say to himself right away, what's the one thing that would make me kill someone?
Right, but what, how would that change? What would he do? He doesn't know who killed his son or who found him. Right, just because he doesn't know. I mean, he still doesn't know who the person is.
It's just, it's a tough ask of me as an audience member to sort of think that and then see him actualize that thought later.
Right. Well, I think that he kind of did. I think that even though we don't see that at all, the fact that he goes after this, knowing that he doesn't know who this man is, and then still deciding to go through all these steps to find this man, knows that he thinks that there's a legitimate reason he would kill him.
Mm-hmm. I also think, though, and we talked about this when we were watching the film, I feel like if you're sitting there at your job, and this is your job, and you all of a sudden see you kill somebody, and you have 2 minutes to run
away.
What
are you
going to do? Yeah, it's just like, I don't know.
But you run away. Do you run towards? I don't know. It's a weird move.
I just think that he didn't have time to process it, maybe.
Yeah, the last thing critically, just when you talk about the person complaining about it, is that a lot of people have a problem with the ending of this movie. The last, 15 or 20 minutes, basically, from the moment that Cruz gets freed.
Mm-hmm.
From the moment that he gets freed up until the very ending and the way it wraps up. And
the eyeball?
Like the Agatha scene on.
Yeah.
The run scene on.
Yeah, film scholar Mark Eric Cooper feels Minority Report emphasizes the future importance of the control over imagery. So basically, what he says in this is that one of the things that, logically raises another issue is that the same concern could be leveled towards image makers such as DreamWorks. And what he basically ends up saying with this, and I kind of agree, is that when the film ends and Cruz is inside his apartment with his wife and she's pregnant and they're looking out and they see just rain falling and there's, no cameras, there's nothing mechanical moving, they don't feel like they're being watched any longer, and they cut to the scene with the twins in the cottage, it's essentially taking all the concepts. What does he say here? The no way to escape the media industry's omnipotence in the future, which is kind of the general feel of the whole movie up until they dissolve pre-crime. Dissolving pre-crime is just one piece, and it feels like when they show the precogs out in a cabin and they look very organic and it's surrounded by a lake.
It's like the end of 28 Days Later. It's just, where they're just in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, it feels like they essentially took this reality, this dark, dark, dark reality. They eliminated pre-crime and they were happily ever after. But that's not... It feels like it's trying to sell you something that isn't really there for you to witness as you're watching the film.
Well, it's true. And that's, it's very... It strays from the feel of the entire film and from the novel. I mean, the short story. Because the short story ends... It's not a good ending. It ends with him getting exiled to a place with his wife and him telling Whitwer, essentially, watch out. It can happen to you at any moment.
Anytime.
You know?
I also morally had a really hard time with the ending of this. And I still don't know exactly how I feel, but... Even if all of the murders that they were trying to figure out, the person wasn't going to kill them. Maybe they were sometimes. I think most of the times, they still saved so many lives.
Yeah,
yeah.
The fact that these three people, I understand they're going through hell every day, reliving or however often it happens that there's murder, living it. But I don't know. I feel like the fact that we're taking them out of the scene completely, they're not helping at all anymore with this. A lot of people are going to die.
Right.
It's true. I just had a hard time with it. I'm not saying that they should be stuck down there. And I know that gets kind of political because that's what you can bring back to the real world. But I did have a hard time with it.
I know.
It's not acknowledged, really.
I had that same thought for a minute. But then I also, you see those stories about people that have spent the last 20 years on death row or that have been executed and then, DNA things come out or they're proved innocent after so long. It's just... The thought of someone being in prison for life for something that they didn't do and were never going to is just it's just incredible to me.
Right, but if there's only about 12 out of a few thousand, I'm not saying that that's not meaningful. It's just it's difficult. Yeah. It's difficult.
I think that basically my biggest complaint is that the last 12, 15 minutes of the movie wraps up very quickly, and I can see that there's probably more movie they didn't show us, but that to me felt a little bit slanted. But let's talk just quickly about the ultimate action scene. What do we think is the ultimate action scene? We have kind of a behind the scenes stunt video we're going to roll here while we're talking. And this is just one of them, which is his escape and riding around and jumping off the... No, this is where he's jumping off the car and he's traveling on the track and all
this
that.
This is cool.
This is cool, but it's just kind of the making of. It's mostly just done CGI, but it looks great.
This is the first time he's everybody runs?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I love that line.
That's a good line.
It's a good line.
So what's the ultimate action scene? Is it the chase with the jetpacks? Is it this scene? Is it the fight in the car factory? I mean, those are probably the three that come to mind.
I'm
going
to call it the fight in the car factory because it's the only thing that was brought over from the original script. It was loved so much through every revision and kept.
Yeah.
And it's like a true action scene. You have like,
you have who you think is the bad guy and Tom Cruise, the good guy, squaring off in a hand-to-hand combat.
Right.
He continues to use his expertise, like he did with the jetpacks, with that, like, boom rifle.
Yeah.
Which is awesome. Super awesome weapon.
Yeah, the pulse rifle.
Yeah, the really six cool. sticks and the pulse rifle
yeah.
are so cool in this movie.
And the music in that scene, too, is yeah. ridiculous.
I was going to say, when I said earlier, the thing that is the most Spielberg-y is the sort of, like, the visual design. The other part of it, I think, is that sequence in particular, with the six stick and the person vomiting, and then, like, going through the floor, the yeah. kids practicing a saxophone. That's so Steven Spielberg.
Right, we were talking about that. We were saying how, like, in action movies, like, in action scenes, a lot of times, it's like the whole rest of the world is kind of put on pause.
Yeah.
No one else is that affected by what's going on. But I like that, and that's Spielberg. And even when, later mm-hmm. on, when they're searching throughout the ghetto, essentially, and they have that overhead view of all yeah. the apartments.
And the people fighting, they stop.
Yeah, there's real life going on everywhere around this moment, it's and like you need to be reminded of it.
It's like he's fascinated by the sort of minutiae, the idiosyncratic minutiae of people's just day-to-day life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he likes to show that. Yeah, I think it's really cool. Yeah, I mean, I would guess if I was going to go with what I think is the ultimate action scene, I think it is probably that one. I think it's the jetpack.
Jetpack scene. So yeah. not the same one as mine.
I don't think so.
I yeah. don't feel like we have to pick because they go right after each other. Right. Like, I feel like it's from the moment he says that on the car and he's like, everybody runs. Then he gets his back against the wall. The dog starts barking, so he gets to leave. Then he makes sure the guy has a good grip, which was a really cool moment.
Yeah,
then with the jetpacks, then the backflip and Colin Farrell trying to chase him. Like, that all kind of was one chase scene. And then up until the point where he gets in the car in the factory and zips away. Like, to me, that was one big scene. Yeah, so I think that is the ultimate action sequence.
Sure.
Oh, I got sure by Ben Bateman.
That's a big deal.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah, I didn't really. That's fair.
Sure. That's fair.
If somebody hasn't called me out on that yet. What's our favorite line? What do we think? Favorite line in the movie? What do you guys got?
I've got a line right here. I don't know who that was. I don't know.
I don't know why you did that. There's no characters with.
I enjoyed it. Embarrassed.
I enjoyed it. I'll stand by that.
It's okay. Thank you.
It was no orange creature from Lilo
and Stitch. Sure. But. Just let me get here. So possession. It's when Colin Farrell catches him in the elevator right when he's starting to run.
Yeah.
And he goes, "Possession alone will cost you 6 months, let alone your badge. Looks like we won't be working together after all. Now put the gun down, John. I don't hear a red ball." And then the alarm goes off.
Yeah.
And there's this look in Colin Farrell's eyes of like, this is it. I'm gonna die right now. Like, this is the moment that I die. Because it's perfect. It's timed perfectly. It's not even the line that's good. I mean, it builds it up.
Yeah.
But, like, when he delivers that part, I don't hear a red ball, and then the alarm goes off, and you see his face.
Yeah.
That's almost like a fist pump moment and my favorite line all at once.
I was just gonna say that.
Yeah. Look at that.
Yeah. And then the other one is, it's when he's talking to the guy that he buys the drugs from in the beginning.
No, don't take mine. You already had one.
No, she took mine earlier.
No.
It's like my daddy used to say.
Oh, this is it.
In the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king.
Okay, all right, okay. Here's the thing. You can't have two. You can have one, and that's mine, so you had a different one. But here's what I have to say about that line. It's really cool, because in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And why that's relevant is later on, when he has to take the patch off of one eye, and they scan it, and he's like, he's the one-eyed man.
Yeah.
It was very, very cool and foreshadowing. I mean, I love that line.
I'm so sad you didn't get to give it as your favorite line. I feel so bad.
I see we've come full circle here.
We have. It's amazing how that works.
We've come full
circle. Okay, guys. Do you have another one, Socks, or is that a
show? That was my line. What do you mean another one?
I didn't know if you had another one you were working on. Okay.
It was a good effort, Ross.
Yeah. Okay, so I have two, but I think which one I like better. I like when the guy says, "Why would you want your eyes?" And he's like, because my mother gave it to me.
It's a great
line. So we all love his eyes.
We all love
the eye lines.
I love that his wife just has them later somehow.
That's
just
great.
The one eye.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He leaves it at the house.
He probably did.
On accident, probably.
You know, because just like I carry mine around in a little Ziploc baggie. I drop it around like my lunch bag.
It's not gross at all. And she like brings it with her to the gala before she knows she's going to have to save Cruz somehow.
Well, she doesn't bring it to the gala. She takes it to the
different moments.
Oh, was there a cut that I missed there? It's like next day or something?
Well, it's just later on after she freezes.
No, isn't she sitting there? Yeah, no. She's sitting there just before Lamar goes into his whole like you know, his moment or whatever.
Well, I guess technically that is like in the back at the gala, isn't it?
Isn't it? Or is a press conference not a gala?
That was a meeting at his house before the press conference, and then there's the gala.
Yeah, yeah. And I also think she kind of was a little skeptical of him.
Yeah,
she already was going into this.
Definitely.
Can we talk about how this movie is just The Fugitive made in the future?
Can we talk about my other favorite line first?
Fine.
What is the deal with the lines? You said line, I had line, you had lines, you have lines. I have a line, and it's all mine.
Pretty White Purple over here did too, so I got to do two.
And I want to shine, because that's the way things are fine.
We stick together. I'm going to do another line here, guys. So it's when Cruz in the opening scene is running around trying to save the day, and it's like culminating, and he doesn't know if the door's open. And Elena's like, she's like, we're catching up to the future. We're running out of time. He's like, shut up, Elena. Just because he's like, Elena. I just like because it's like such a, it's like a rude thing to say to the person that's working for you, but he's so focused.
Right.
He's so just in it that he's just like, he just doesn't matter. Just be like, fuck off, Elena. I'm doing my job right now.
Right.
That's awesome. Anyway. Did you want to say something, Rox?
No, I really didn't.
So,
the fugitive
okay.
thing.
Oh,
is,
yeah, yeah.
Is this what real? We're you notice this?
Yeah, man.
A man wrongfully framed.
Yeah.
He suspects it's his friend that does it, someone he works with. He's spotted on the train by someone that recognizes him. By reading a newspaper that has his face on it, he cuts his hair and dyes it. Tom Cruise changes out his eyes to change his appearance, and lastly, they're both confronted. They both confront the villain of the movie at a gala, for their honor.
That is pretty darn good.
That's good.
It's really
good.
Boom. It's good.
That should have been your thesis statement.
And then
you guys wouldn't have had the same one.
Yes. Yes, yes, sir.
Did you just realize that right now while you're thinking about it?
Yep, clearly.
I didn't. I thought about it earlier.
Why did you say it's your thesis statement?
Because
that's so much
better.
Because
I liked my thesis statement.
It's not any better. They're both of equal value.
Because it's your thesis statement, too. All right, let's talk hero villain ranking, guys. So we have a list
that we
like to reference now, and we've talked about this list forever.
We have it.
It was the where do the heroes and the villains rank, and this time we can show the list. Now, Roxy, it's very far away on the television up there for us, so we're going to have to just relay the information to you.
Okay, I'm ready for it.
Because it's not on the outline in front of us here. But
we're very good at our jobs.
I don't find any part of this movie to rank.
I was just going to say, now that we've built it all up with our hero-villain rankings, they don't rank in this movie.
Completely agree.
Yeah, it's awesome.
And that's weird.
It is.
Like, I don't think that anybody knows what Tom Cruise's name in this movie is after a month later from watching it.
When we were watching the movie, before they say it, I was like, what's his name in the movie again?
I was like, Anders?
Yeah.
Yeah. Nope.
So there's that.
John. Yeah, so
I mean, there's not a lot to talk about. You guys can see our updated list, though, if you guys are watching at home. You can see, you know, what we've done over the last few weeks.
I'm going to have to watch at home, then.
Last week, The Matrix yielded some pretty incredible results. It
absolutely
put a hero and a villain into both of our top tens. In fact, Agent Smith is my number four. It was a huge one. Breaking into the top five is tough.
Yeah. He was my number five, wasn't he?
Yeah, a few five, and then Neo was your six. Neo was your five.
I feel like there are 10 people in both your top fives.
No, it's right there. You can see it. Well, you can't, but actually.
You go up and if you get up and walk over there.
Anyway, that's your villain ranking.
Yeah, which is cool because it gives us more time to talk about our five recasts.
Yeah, this is a good one, guys. So recasts is the thing that we do every week. We take five roles in the film and we recast them. It's always weird when you do the ones from 02 because you have to decide if you were remaking it today or if you wanted to go older. In this case, I think we would do modern day. So This is if the film were to be remade, not as a TV show, today. Who would you put in the movie? Who would play the main roles? I think we should start with the creepy doctor, Peter Stormare, Dr. Solomon Eddy.
I like that guy's in the movie for like 5 minutes, but his role is so impactful.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so the other one that we considered recasting, by the way, was the kid who is the caretaker. Because just the one line that he has with Cruz when the alarm goes off and he looks up and he's like, I like you, Chief. You've always been nice to me.
Yeah.
I'll give you 2 minutes before I hit the alarm.
Great line.
It's one of the most memorable lines in the whole movie, I think. So,
and he's actually Wally in the TV show.
Is he really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He's the same character.
Huh.
Not doing a lot of work.
I guess. Well, that's a big deal. Fox.
No, it's huge.
Anyway, that's who we're going to start with. I'll start. You know what? I always go that way.
Yeah, why don't you start?
I'll jump in. I went with Jim Carrey. And the reason I did was because he's fairly comic in this movie. He's kind of a weird, like,
very over the top.
Kind of over the top. Like, yeah, he's having a lot of fun with the role. And one of the things about Carrey that I like so much is that when he plays a role straight, when he plays it totally straight, he's kind of that same weird and a little bit funny. But I think he would be terrifying if he just played this as, like, creepy old Jim Carrey.
It's like straight, doesn't shave his beard or anything.
And if they were to remake this movie today, it would totally be the kind of bit part where Jim Carrey played that role. I would be so satisfied with it. I wouldn't feel weird at all, like when Matt Damon showed up in Interstellar. Hated that, right?
Yeah.
It's the worst. Yeah, I would just love to see Jim Carrey in this role, so that's fine.
Shout out to Jim Carrey and what he's going through right now. We're very sorry to hear about everything that's going on in your life. That is not...
Yeah,
that is not very happy.
No, it's very strange.
So, our thoughts and prayers go out to you, my friend. I went with Charlito Copley. I love when that guy plays weird. He's so good. I think he'd be a great doctor. If you've seen him with, like, the long, stringy hair, he's an excellent weirdo.
The comedic timing could be a little...
Really? What comedic timing?
Like, I just thought that this was the one part of the movie where I kind of giggled.
He's a little funny.
And he can do funny. You guys have seen District 9. You guys have seen the A-Team, right?
I just like that I paused for a while to defend you.
It did, because in the car, you're like, oh, that's great.
And I was like, yeah, I know okay. It is. I think it's okay. I think both of yours are okay. I think mine crushes both of yours, though.
What do you got?
So I thought a lot about this one. And I'm gender swapping here, and I'm cutting the assistant because I didn't need her. And I'm going with Helena Bonham Carter, who would have crushed this role.
Okay, that's fair.
What? I was expecting, like, drop mic, leave room, best recast of all time.
You can leave the room.
You don't think she would have been awesome? She's so weird, and she would have been,
I think it's
creepy and funny.
I think it's good.
And she would have been messing with his eyes, and it would have been like a Tim Burton moment.
Look, I didn't just give you a long pause where I sort of just shrugged my shoulders.
Andrew didn't even care. Andrew didn't even care.
He's mad.
I'm not mad. I just don't think it's a great recap.
I think it was really good. It was strong.
No, I think Marvel Movie News is a really good show. I'm
done with you guys. I'm never coming back.
Don't lie on air. We'll see you back real soon.
Let's move to Max von Sydow, Lamar Burgess. I went with Bryan Cranston because I think Cranston's reaching a point now.
Did you move away from me?
If you make up Bryan Cranston, like if you make him look a little older, he can play the older character well. And the really kind of intense and terrifying father figure that he played in Breaking Bad, constantly saying son when he was talking to Jesse, it's the same character you see here. The only difference is that Burgess is sort of physically weaker looking. He's like just a bit more frail.
Yeah.
And that's the only thing in Cranston's character. But I think you could make him that way if you wanted. If Cranston was to, like, do some kind of a starvation diet to really look frail for the character, I think it could be kind of crazy and very scary.
So I kind of cheated with mine because he was who Steven Spielberg originally wanted. But I've also wanted to use him since forever.
Since X-Men 1 came out.
Yeah. Sir Ian McKellen. He is phenomenal. He is frail and old. And I took Roxanne.
Yeah, but I have backup because I figured one of you would take him. Okay. So I have backup.
Is it Patrick Stewart?
No, but it almost was. That was almost
Wilford
my backup.
Is it Brimley?
No, but Ian McKellen is the person that would be the best choice for this. I agree.
Is it Tom Wilkinson?
No. It's none of them. It goes a completely different direction.
Christopher Plummer.
Over Winfrey.
Go. Helena Bonham Carter.
No, it's John Voight, who I think would do a really good job in this role too, but do something very different. He would do something very different, but I do think that Ian McKellen would crush as well.
Feed me the line, Andrew. Gives me.
Snakes don't eat people.
I don't know.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's great.
I don't know.
His accent in Anaconda is just... We just need to do a whole show on just him in Anaconda.
Or not just even the accents in general,
character
studies.
Anaconda is a perfect killing machine.
Samantha Morton, who played Agatha.
Roxy, I liked your recast there. I didn't just skip it. Sorry.
It was mine.
How do you know what I? How did you know what I did for Agatha? Oh no, the one that we just did.
Just because I talked over you. Yeah, didn't mean to.
You know.
Let's get to Samantha Morton, who plays Agatha. I went with Rooney Mara, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
I almost did.
Yeah,
but these are a lot of good ones.
It's a little bit of a cop out because she's a very pretty girl that played a really weird character recently. Mm-hmm. But I still think it's good.
Yeah, it's a great one.
Totally.
Yeah.
Good to go. Rocks.
Oh, I went with Shailene Woodley.
Oh, God. Really? This is absurd. I want to strip him from the records. I want to start this episode.
I want her out. The show.
I need a producer in here immediately.
I'm pretty glad that I went first on that one, but mine are typed, so you know. I think that she is not big enough that it would be weird yet, but in a couple of years she might be big enough. I think that she would look just like so helpless and childlike. But why are you going like that?
I'm very the same upset one with you again.
Angry.
We could have worked on this movie together.
We did
work on this movie together.
We were up at 5 a.m.
And she's so talented, and Fault in Our Stars proved that she has the range to do this, so.
Yep.
Do you have a backup?
Emilia Clarke. good. It's my backup.
Not today, Khaleesi.
Yeah, but she would be like, I need to be in full clothes.
Yeah. Right, yeah. She doesn't do nudity anymore?
Yeah.
Oh, well, she always had a body double, right?
No, she used to not. And then she was like, I'm not doing this anymore. Right. Which, by the way, no judgment. It sounded like I was judging her. She can do what she wants.
Stupid doesn't want to be nude on camera.
Roxy, the next time you do our show, would you mind doing it nude? Is that okay?
We'll get you a body double.
Maybe if you paid more respect to my recasting, you know?
Just her head on my body.
If you guys want to see Roxy nude, go to Marvel Movie News Week. let's talk about Colin Farrell as a recast. I love mine, and this is just because I think that Colin Farrell is kind of a fuck in this movie.
I think we have the same one.
Shia LaBeouf?
No.
I went with Shia LaBeouf. I just think he's...
Just do it!
Yeah, like, I'm all in on Shia LaBeouf. Like, I bought a lot of stuff in Shia LaBeouf recently. Like, I think that he's, like...
Did you say you bought a lot of stock in Shia LaBeouf?
Like, investment. Like, I believe in him. I think he's coming back around. I think Shia LaBeouf's going to have, like, an Oscar-winning performance, and he's going to blow everyone away.
You think Fury was the turning point?
I think Shia LaBeouf's good, and I think he's too. So crazy that I think people are like, he's insane. But I think like he'll be in some movie where people are like,
he would do a good job. Because
he was looked at as like the new Leonardo DiCaprio like back in the day when he was like on his way.
On
like,
Even Stevens?
No, after... Really?
You said back in the day.
Show and Holes?
He's been around for a long time.
Yeah, I used to say that I thought Shia LaBeouf had Cruisisms. Like, I thought he had the same kind of energy in a lot of ways. But he's kind of crazy. But I think he'd be great. It's Colin Farrell.
I'm going first.
No, I'm going to go first. I'm scared.
I did Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Oh, okay, good. I almost, but
JGL,
no.
JGL, he's great.
It's great.
That's a good one. I did Jeremy Renner.
Oh, really?
That's funny.
That is funny.
I'll tell you why.
Because you cast him as the lead?
I did.
I like Jeremy Renner for this role more than I like him as the lead, actually.
Thank you so much. Wow. I really appreciate that.
I'm so glad you guys are having so much fun. I cast Jeremy Renner as Tom. I hate this show.
All right, who did you cast?
For Cruz?
Yeah.
Michael Fassbender.
And this is a great cast. I was actually going to originally write Fassbender.
Because we use Fassbender as a villain so much on this show. I mean, he's probably... He and Hardy, right? Hero and villain are the two most...
Yeah, Hardy's
two favorites.
Everything.
They're the ones that we recast everything with. But I've never used Fassbender as a hero. And this feels like one of the few times I can think of where I would totally buy him as a hero. See, here's the thing about this recast that I think is really, really interesting and why I think it's a difficult one. You're... As Tom Cruise in this role, you're asked to blindly believe in an idealistic future that is morally wrong because you're keeping people chained up sort of against their will, essentially. And... His earnestness to believe in the cause sells it extremely well because Tom Cruise, we talk about his aggressive sincerity, right? That's like what he has. So that's what he has in spades. So what he's best at. It makes a lot of sense that he would be so good at this role. And it's because of the Scientology thing because we've all seen him talk so intently about something that is so foreign to so many people, or at least so many people like necessarily don't understand or, you know, whatever. So to get someone who could do this with the same level of commitment and intensity is very hard. And that's why I think you need someone like Fassbender who's not just your normal sort of positive leading man, somebody that has a lot of intensity.
Mm.
It's true. That he's the first person that popped in my head.
Great.
But I've used him so many times, I just didn't want to. But I've never used him as a hero. That's great. It's probably the best cast you've ever done.
And I thought of it first. I just didn't tell you. Exactly. I'm taking Fassbender. Come up with a new one.
Who'd you do, Rox?
I have two. I have who I really think would blow everybody away, but the studios would never cast. And then I have somebody that I think that they would cast and who would do a really good job.
Sure.
Who I would want would be Charlie Cox from Daredevil.
Okay.
Who I think would be amazing.
He's great. I love him.
But he's just not big enough yet.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't be able to sell this movie. And then as long as he like de-southpawed and like was not as big as he is, I think that Jake Gyllenhaal would do
Forrest
a really
Whitaker?
Good job. Oh. Yes.
You love Jake Gyllenhaal.
I think he is the most talented actor of our time.
Really?
Yeah.
Right, let's not get into that conversation.
Big fan.
He's very good, though.
He's very good.
D-Day Lou. Go ahead.
That's the first time I ever said that out loud. Yeah. I guess I just said that.
That's a big claim.
I think he is ridiculously good.
I love Jake Gyllenhaal.
Big All right, fan. Let's... Okay, I can't. Okay, let's move on. I just want to ask about like other actors and be like, really? You think he's better than this and this?
But do you guys? You could have him on Marvel Movie News to talk about it.
Yeah, no? He did that movie.
We've made the joke six times anymore.
Yeah, we got to stop it.
Okay,
I'm gonna cry. I'm gonna cry on air.
She's on DC Movie News, guys. If you just tune into the show, we're just kidding. She's actually on Marvel Movie News. Let's get into the last part of the show, which is we just did the last part of the show.
No, wait, no. Which are the three categories?
The three categories. We don't have to do Cage versus Cruz because Cruz is in this.
Do I have the last page?
No,
it doesn't matter.
It's know what it is.
I need to go on the outline.
He's like Ron Burgundy, guys. He can't do the show if he doesn't have something to read.
There are three categories that action movies traditionally fit into, in our opinion. Those three categories are totally legitimate, totally ridiculous, and ridiculously legitimate. Totally legitimate would be characterized by The Fugitive, which is a movie that is not Die Hard because we don't agree on Die Hard anymore.
Yeah.
Movies that are totally real, great, strong, dramatically, they don't really ever veer off a cliff where you feel like it's kind of silly. Totally ridiculous are movies that completely fall off that cliff. Face Off and Con Air come to mind, and movies in the middle category, which is sort of the ideal one, legitimately ridiculous, or ridiculously legitimate, I think you can call it either one, are movies like The Rock or Point Break, movies like Speed.
You did great.
What? You did great. I was going to lend you, because it's typed here, I was going to lend you mine, but you did well.
I've done this 24 times, so.
About.
Yeah.
Around that.
Roughly.
I don't want to go first.
Okay. Just Roxy's going to steal your answer.
Ben, you go.
This movie is totally legit.
Totally legit.
Okay. Yeah, fully. I can't see any way that I could poke holes in it. Like, it would be, there's no part of this movie I laugh at.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's the middle category, and it's definitely not totally ridiculous. It's legit.
Yeah.
I think it's totally legitimate.
Yeah.
Totally legitimate. I think you could make an argument because of the fact that we were talking about this could never happen and what mm-hmm. that means, but I think it's totally legitimate, and it's very political, and there's a lot of stuff that relates, so totally legitimate.
Oh, yeah, we didn't even talk about how Homeland Security and post 9/11, how much this affected people when they watched this mm-hmm. movie.
Probably a little too close to home was another reason that wasn't remembered as fondly as it got.
True.
Otherwise would have been.
Hmm.
I don't know why I'm having a hard time saying it's totally legitimate. I do believe it, but I feel like if I were to, like... Yeah, no, I mean, it is totally legitimate. That's definitely what I think, but for some reason, I feel like it's leaning towards ridiculously legitimate. Mm. I don't know why, so I'm going to stick with totally legitimate.
Because Cruz runs so much?
He does run an exorbitant amount in this movie. No. It's totally legit.
He's a talented runner. By the way, any of our fans that watch the show and just, like, love Tom Cruise as much as we do, or realize how much passion we have for Tom Cruise... I mean, eventually we'll probably start just trying to contact his people to eventually try to get him on the show, would be my guess.
Ben would lose it.
I would lose my mind, but if anybody wants to start that process by just tweeting at Tom Cruise, they just think you're the greatest thing since sliced bread, you know, feel free to do it. Help us out.
Cheese for me, honestly.
And on top of doing that, guys, we are going to announce right now the winner of our fourth mug giveaway for the Action Movie Anatomy mugs. And it is Mr. Flurry23. I think I wrote that correctly. I copied it down from iTunes. It's either Fury23.
How do we know it's a mister?
Or we don't.
What if it's a person that just likes McFlurries? It is
person. Girl Flurry power. Fury23.
Yeah. As well as JLF Plus, Scoops35, and Hearst. We don't need to give you a specific shout out, Hearst. You know who you are.
You know who you are.
You're the three folks that have won mugs. So we haven't heard from any of you except for Hearst. But the first two, JLF Plus and Scoops35, left us wonderful reviews. And if you guys want to let us know any information...
All of them left us wonderful reviews.
Yes, of course. Any information to get you your mug when we have them, that would be helpful for us because we currently haven't heard from you. So
how do I get a mug?
Well, Roxy, you
go and fill out a review on iTunes.
Go and rate and review the show on iTunes.
And if we pick you out randomly, which we won't because you're still on my ideas...
I'm going to sign in under a fake name, and then you're going to pick me, and
I'm
going
to
tell you.
Should, I feel like this is getting uncomfortable. You guys should talk about this off camera.
Are you uncomfortable? I feel great.
I love him.
I love you.
All right, that's going to do it, guys. That's the show. That's Action Movie Anatomy, episode, 23,
I believe.
Episode 23.
Where did this go?
That's a lot. Roxy, thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
I know, guys, we joke around a lot. We're all friends here. Roxy is just the best.
I really appreciate it.
She's the best. Roxy, where can people find you?
You guys can find me everywhere at Roxy Stryer.
Okay,
and DC Movie News. Really? You expect to be a longer thing? Like, it just happens.
You can find me on Twitter at Andrew Guy. I'm recently at 76 followers, going for that 100. Quest for 100.
It's coming along. It's coming along.
Your 100th will get a mug.
No.
100th Twitter follower. And you guys can find me at... Oh, by the way, I didn't even point this out. Player 23, in your review, you mentioned Minority Report. You asked us to actually do it, which was a great review, and then it's also poignant that we picked you for today. So that's a good thing. You guys can find me at Ben Bateman Media on Twitter and Instagram. Twitter probably mostly these days. And I do AfterBuzz TV shows and Black Hollywood Live shows and shows here.
A little show called Fear of the Walking Dead.
Fear of the Walking Dead. They're all related networks. They're all, you know...
You Instagram twice a day. What is Twitter more so these days?
Well, like two times the other day, but normally it's like twice a week. Guys, thanks for coming and checking out the show. We'll see you soon. We'll see you next week.
Thank you so much.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Spitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, We would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.